Hello again. This is an update of some potential scandals facing President Trump. First, from apparent conflicts of interest involving his family. Later on, we'll hear about information compiled by Christopher Steele, the former British spy, about Russia's involvement in last year's elections. It's traditional for Republicans to demand that government be run like a business. President Trump is accused of making that family business. When his daughter Ivanka and her husband Jared Kushner were named senior members of the White House staff, one comedian who took notice was Stephen Colbert.
Kushner will become the head of something called the Office of American Innovation. Vague, but still better than the original title, the Bureau of Obvious Nepotism. But Kushner's job will be to lead a team to fix government with business ideas. And you know he's got great business ideas, like being born into a wealthy real estate family or marrying into a wealthy real estate family. Why hasn't the government tried that?
Well, now it's more than a year into the Trump administration, and the government is trying that. And questions about the Kushners have piled up. Have they used their White House clout to advance not just the interests of the United States, but their own interests as well? A case in point, financing for their signature property, the high-rise at 666 Fifth Avenue in New York City. Here's Ryan Grimm with The Intercept, an organization that prides itself on adversarial journalism. Ryan Grimm, great to have you.
Oh, great to be here.
Well, tell us, if you will, about the financing of 666 Fifth Avenue and the governor of government of Qatar.
Well, it has been desperately needed. This was a signature, as you said, property that Kushner himself purchased. It was his biggest and splashiest buy in 2007. He set a record in Manhattan for the most expensive piece of real estate. Observers of the market at the time said that it was already overpriced badly, well over $1 billion, before the market tanked. And, you know, around 2007, you could kind of see the writing on the wall there. So after it tanked, it was badly, badly underwater. And so he has had a looming balloon payment coming that, if he was unable to make it, you know, threatened to bring down the entire empire, because you in real estate have a lot of these properties cross-collateralized. And so the only places to go for these sorts of this amount of money are places like the Middle East, China, Russia, maybe somewhere like Malaysia. There aren't people that can cut, you know, $500 million to $1 billion checks all over the place.
But one government that presumably could is the government of Qatar. What happened? What was the connection between that government and the Kushner properties? And what about American policy toward that country?
Yeah, they certainly could. Qatar runs either the richest or the second richest sovereign wealth fund in the world. And so Charles Kushner, we reported just recently and last week, Charles Kushner.
He's the father of Jared.
Right. Father of Jared, who speaks to Jared on a daily basis. Sat down with the Minister of Finance, Qatar, and pitched him on financing 666 Fifth Avenue. So this is, you know, this is after Jared had already become a senior White House advisor. They had a follow-up meeting the next day. It eventually fell apart because it's, according to the Qataris, it's a terrible deal. The math just isn't there. And within a matter of weeks, Trump and Kushner traveled to Riyadh, and they had that famous, hands on the orb moment. And then shortly after that, the Saudi Arabia and UAE launched a blockade of Qatar, which Trump, on the advice of Kushner, very actively supported. And he supported it against the advice of the Secretary of State, who was publicly trying to mediate the dispute and pointing out that there are thousands of American servicemen and women stationed in Qatar and blockading our troops might not be the best thing. But Trump and Kushner undercut Tillerson, and the blockade continues to this day.
How did they argue that the blockade was in American interest?
They all they said was that Qatar has been a financier of terrorism, and so therefore needed to be brought to heel. Saudi Arabia was, and UAE are insisting that it shut Al Jazeera down, which it said the media property was fomenting unrest around the Middle East. You know, the kind of hypocrisy of Saudi Arabia accusing another country of financing violent extremism wasn't lost on anybody except perhaps the president. Rex Tillerson later came to believe that the statement that Trump issued undermining the talks was written by the ambassador from the UAE and delivered to his friend Kushner, who delivered it to Trump.
And you say the blockade is still in existence. Has there been any damage to American interests as a result? Have servicemen and women been troubled in any way by that?
Well, the economy has been teetering. So you'd have to ask the people there how that has affected them. The country has gotten much closer to Iran as a result of this. You know, they have been an ally of you know other Gulf countries up until this point. Now they have moved much closer to Turkey and Iran, you know, kind of out of necessity, not just political necessity, but the need for you know fuel and food. To keep the population alive. So, if you think that you know losing a wealthy ally to the Iranian orbit is against the interests of the U.S., then absolutely.
So there appears to be a conflict of interest. An apparent conflict of interest is one of the things that is concerned about. We don't have a provable quid pro quo as yet, but we do have other concerns, one of them involving the Apollo company and the other involving Citigroup. Go ahead.
Oh, sure. So this is one that was elevated by the New York Times recently. About $184 million flowed from Apollo to the Kushners for a property in Chicago. And there's been some speculation because Apollo has some ties to Qatar, and Qatar was tied in with a 20%, roughly 20% sale of Rosneft, a giant Russian company that appeared in the dossier, and that there may be some connection between these flows of money, and that Mueller may be looking into this, so you know very quickly you're getting into you know kind of the heart of the Mueller investigation. Though, to me that might even be thinking about it too much when you might have just right in front of you a massive scandal without having to go any further.
So we have Apollo. We also have Citigroup.
Right, and Citigroup. This week is looking to get a big old giveaway in the Senate from a rollback of Wall Street reform. So things are things are going all right for them. But yeah, Citigroup also lent the Kushner companies a sizable amount of money after Citigroup representatives have met with Jared Kushner. That was also reported by the Times. So there was no smoking gun there to suggest that there was a quid pro quo on that.
Okay. Well, again, the appearances may be there. We don't know yet about any provable quid pro quo. Ryan Grimm with The Intercept, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. We're talking about the Trump administration and family ties. When they were drafting the Constitution, the founding fathers were concerned about foreign influence. In Federalist Paper number 68, Alexander Hamilton said that was the reason for the Electoral College. With electors who held no office themselves and would be free of corrupting influences from overseas. Kathleen Clark is professor of legal and government ethics at Washington University School of Law in St. Louis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's go back a bit to Federalist Paper number 68. And there were, in fact, exchanges of valuable property, one of them involving Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, Zephyr Teachout has written a whole book on sort of the corrupting the sources of corruption back to our founding fathers, and I think a snuff box that was given to Benjamin Franklin, if I'm correct. But the main point
had jewels on it, I think.
Correct, correct. But the main point, I think, is that our founders were concerned that government officials could be corrupted, could be influenced improperly by foreign governments or foreign princes, by being given benefits of one kind or another. And so banned not just the president, but all federal officials from accepting a benefit from a foreign government unless Congress consented to that. And that's referred to as the Foreign Emoluments Clause within our Constitution.
Yeah, as I understand it, though, you said it extends to all public officials. There are those who say it only extends to appointed officials and not necessarily to elected ones. I take it this has never actually been litigated before the U.S. Supreme Court.
It is correct that there is very little litigation on this because the primary mode of enforcing it has been within the executive branch. The Justice Department has an office called the Office of Legal Counsel, which provides legal opinions that are binding on the executive branch. And that office, until recently anyway, the Justice Department until recently, until the Trump administration, took the view that the Emoluments Clause prohibited a federal official, even a part-time federal official, from even participating in a commercial transaction with a foreign government. But it's not just gifts. It includes other kinds of benefits, including the benefits that are received as a result of commercial transactions. So our Justice Department has prevented folks from, you know, government officials from accepting these corrupting payments until now, until this presidency.
Does it appear that either Jared Kushner or his wife, Ivanka, have in fact accepted anything that would have been prevented in prior administrations?
I believe so. I believe that Ivanka has accepted trademarks from China, among other from other countries as well, but certainly from the government of China, and that would be, of course, a benefit to her, and could be corrupting. So I believe that such a trademark would not have been acceptable under a previous administration, where the president himself would not have been, of course, conflicted either.
So there's a real question as to whether any of the family members, including the president, have divested themselves sufficiently of their interest.
Yeah, I think that is the case. We, of course, don't know all the facts on this, the interactions of the Kushner family and Cotter, and whether or not there was either a quid pro quo or some kind of retaliation, or simply Kushner and the U.S. government being manipulated by foreign governments in response to, or, you know, cognizant of the Kushner's family's desperate need for capital in connection with this particular building in Manhattan. But I do think it's clear that what we have here is an administration that is severely compromised. It's compromised in multiple ways, and it's additionally compromised by bringing in these unqualified, non-expert relatives who lack both expertise and experience, we all will suffer the results of this sort of this lack of expertise and these conflicts and the effects that may have on our government.
And you use the term manipulation. There have been reports that intelligence officials of the United States have said that they have overheard foreign entities talking about how they could, in fact, manipulate Jared Kushner in particular because of his inexperience. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So I believe that the New York Times. But anyway, last week there were news reports that officials from four different countries, I believe, were known to have been discussing ways to manipulate or affect Kushner, to sort of push Kushner into positions that would favor these particular countries or act in ways that would work for them, in light of not just his inexperience, but also his substantial conflicts of interest. And the story that your previous guest just, you know, had reported on and told in connection with Cotter and the Kushner family, that our U.S. policy changing toward Cotter a month after the Kushner family sought financing from that government to bail them out of their, troubled property on Fifth Avenue. That is just, I think, one of the examples, I believe, of the kind of vulnerabilities we have thanks to the president's appointment of these relatives, Jared and Ivanka, to the White House.
Kathleen Clark, professor of legal and government ethics at Washington University School of Law. We're going to continue in just a moment. So, what do we know about President Trump that explains his reliance on family members despite the appearance, at least, of conflict? David K. Johnston is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He's author of The Making of Donald Trump, and more recently, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. David K. Johnston, welcome.
Well, thank you, Warren.
Let's go back, first of all, to The Making of Donald Trump. You go way into his biography in that book, and tell us, if you will, what it is about him that suggests that he is so dependent, or that makes him so dependent, on people close to him, even people with family ties.
Well, Donald is not at all a competent manager. Many of the executives he had, for example, in his casino business, he got rid of very quickly once they challenged him on anything, and they went on generally to really good careers, and he appointed drunks and yes men and people who did whatever he wanted, which is one of the reasons his casinos were among the first to fold. He also comes from a family with a long history of doing what Trump himself has done, which is thumb his nose at the law. His grandfather was a draft dodger from Germany who made a fortune running whorehouses in the western United States. His father ripped off the taxpayers for millions of dollars, enough that President Eisenhower threw a fit about it in the Oval Office and ordered a major investigation of Fred Trump. And Fred Trump's business partner was a guy named Willie Tomasello, who's identified in public official government reports as an associate for the Gambino and Genovese crime families. So Trump comes at this through a long history of, swindling people, cheating people, not paying workers, not paying vendors, using two sets of books, hiding records. It's just who he is.
Well, other people have had, or other high officials that are much admired, have had contacts that were suspicious going back in their families. The Kennedys was one of them.
Well, yes, without question. But Trump is different in that, rather than these being sort of things on the side of his life or occasional matters, these are right at the core of who Donald is. He's, been identified in numerous lawsuits, investigative reports, audit reports, as somebody who is, he's essentially a con artist and a swindler. And he spent his entire life not paying obligations that he had. He's been tried twice civilly for income tax fraud, lost both cases. He's confessed to sales tax fraud. And he's always run his business with a handful of people who were totally dependent on him and from whom he expected total loyalty. And as a business person, Warren, he could rip you off, rip me off, rip off the guy next door, and then move on to another mark. As president of the United States, he has to go back and deal with the same people over and over, the same leader of the Senate, the same leader of the House, the same dictator in North Korea. And Trump doesn't know how to operate in an environment where he can't use you up, throw you aside, and move on.
Well, what about the family members he has brought in to help him out then? What's wrong with them? Why do you say that it's worse than it looks? If, in fact, he needs these people and brings them in for that reason, he's not a confident manager, you said at the outset.
Because they're not any better at managing than he is. They're part of the same apparatus. The reason we are so alarmed about nepotism, the reason it was such a big issue in this country when Jack Kennedy made his brother Robert his attorney general, is we don't want conflicts between your family interests or your personal business interests and the welfare of our country. You take an oath to defend and protect the Constitution and to faithfully execute the laws. Look what's happened under the Trumps now. Jared Kushner's family is in very deep financial trouble. They could lose their fortune because of this serious mistake that Ryan Grimm talked about, where he overpaid at the top of a market for 666 Fifth Avenue, and they have a balloon note coming due in 2019. So he's been out trying to raise money. Members of the family, after he went to the White House, have been trying to raise money. When they go to Qatar and are turned down because it's a bad deal, what happens? Well, suddenly, we begin attacking Qatar, the president of the United States, ignoring Saudi Arabians, who are the number one financiers of terrorism in the world, goes after the people in Qatar, where we have our most important military base in the Middle East. And to think these things aren't connected is just silly, but even if you want to assume that they're not, it certainly creates the appearance of impropriety. The Chinese, Trump ran for office heavily critical of the Chinese, and then the Chinese government, with rapid speed, absolutely unseen speed, suddenly approves dozens of trademarks for Ivanka Trump and other Trump family entities, and suddenly Donald Trump speaks well of the Chinese. Clearly, this is not putting America first and putting aside your own private business interests.
Let me open up the mics between the two of you and first go back to Kathleen Clark and ask you, is there a mechanism now whereby, if in fact there are conflicts that are damaging to the United States, anybody could do anything about it?
Well, there are at least two individuals or institutions that could do something about it. If indeed Jared Kushner was involved in government matters, say, in connection with Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and acted in a way that was in his own financial interest, if that is the case, then he may have violated a criminal conflict of interest statute. And there's been reporting that Robert Mueller is examining whether there may be a connection between Kushner's government actions and his private financial interest. So that could be rolled into the Mueller investigation. That's one possibility. A second possibility is that Congress, if Congress actually cared, could take quite a bit of action on this front, both in terms of this immediate concern regarding Qatar, but more generally regarding President Donald Trump's many conflicts of interest, both in connection with China, the trademarks he got from China, and his debts, his to unknown creditors. And so if Congress ends up, if the opposition party, Democrats, end up getting control of one house of Congress, I would imagine that we will see quite an energetic investigation. There will be plenty to investigate. But right now, Congress, of course, is controlled by the president's party, and they have been complicit in the conflict of interests that have been endemic in the Trump administration.
Strong word, David K. Johnston, complicit.
Oh, I think that's exactly what they've done here. And, of course, Trump isn't really a Republican. He's a Republican of convenience because it got him to the White House. But clearly, the Republican leadership has decided that they're better off with Trump than in questioning him, to the point that they haven't even set out to protect their own institutional interests in some cases. And to Kathleen's point about who can take action, you and I, as citizens, can't. We have had one court ruling so far on the Emoluments Clause in a not very well-brought case, but the fundamental finding by the federal judge who threw it out was that citizens don't have standing, that is, a legal right, to enforce the Emoluments Clause. That's not the job of ordinary citizens. So it's up to Congress or it's up to a prosecutor, and the only prosecutor that's going to be is Mueller, the special prosecutor, to pursue this, or else they're just words on paper. After all, the Constitution requires human beings to act ethically and courageously at times in order to make the Constitution's promises reality.
How do you read the denial of the top secret clearance to Jared Kushner and the fact that he hasn't been able to get security clearance from not just the the chief of staff of the White House, but the intelligence agencies who oversee that. How important is that? And do you think it's enough, David K. Johnston, to actually get Jared Kushner removed from the White House?
I doubt he'll be removed over this for a very simple reason. The president of the United States has the authority to declassify anything he wants. And while this is way outside the norms, and it is certainly an area that Kathleen is much more expert on than I am, the president can say, show him the presidential daily brief, give him that or this or that top secret document, and he will get it.
Kathleen Clark, what about it? Is that do you think then that we'll simply see this ongoing in the way that David K. Johnston describes it until somebody, perhaps Mueller, perhaps the Congress, actually does something?
I would say that you're right that the president has the authority to declassify information, but that also requires that some national security professionals within the White House act in a way that is complicit with this irregularity with regard to Kushner. It may take a resignation or some other sort of point of where something comes to a head. I mean, frankly, reading about how compromised Kushner is, and this the way he's compromised not just in terms of his ethics, but also in terms of his fitness for a security clearance. It's really quite shocking that he still has his job, but it's difficult to fire a family member. And it's also quite difficult to challenge a family member with a boss. But it may take someone within the White House being willing to speak truth to power to get Kushner out of there.
Let me ask you both, what about Ivanka?
Oy. I say oy because, I'm just struck that one of the sort of geopolitical situations that is most fraught now, that is makes us vulnerable in ways that I don't know that we really have been in more than a decade or two, is the Korean Peninsula. And who does the president send to, communicate U.S. policy at the closing of the Olympics and meet privately with the head of South Korea? He sends Ivanka, who, of course, has no subject matter expertise. No offense to her, but the American public deserves better than that. There are people who are in a good position to represent United States interests. And if Donald Trump, if President Trump put the American people first, he would not be sending his daughter and his son-in-law as the envoys to get U.S., Middle East peace and represent U.S. interests in areas that are so fraught.
Go ahead.
I agree, Warren, with everything Kathleen said, and let me just add a couple more points to that. Donald Trump has dropped all efforts to create a trading zone in the Pacific. He killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership. China has stepped forward with the RCEP, which almost nobody in America has even heard of, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, and it is increasing its economic and military interests through this partnership, which just took a big advance in the most recent round of talks on it, and tilting countries away from Washington towards Beijing. Well, Ivanka Trump, who is relying on trademarks from China for part of her income, is nobody to be involved in this in any manner, way, shape, or form. And the damage in the long run to China getting the RCEP put in place and becoming the dominant power sooner rather than later or ever in the Pacific Rim is enormous. And frankly, I don't understand why this isn't major page one news in the United States.
What about Donald Trump Jr. going to India? He seemed to have mixed roles of the sort we've heard about with both Ivanka and Jared. He was a government spokesperson. He also was selling Trump properties.
Well, this is why I refer to this as not just a kakistocracy, that is a government of the most venal, the most corrupt, the most incompetent, but also a kleptocracy. And everything Donald Trump has touched in his life and his family around him is how do we extract money? They're not even business builders who build up the businesses and make more and more wealth. They are people who are in the business of getting business connections, extracting cash, letting the business collapse, and moving on to the next mark so they can extract more money. And this deal in India goes directly contrary to the promises we had that there weren't going to be any more foreign deals once Donald Trump took office. And they even have a loophole in the promise to disgorge profits. If you're a foreign government and you rent rooms from a Trump hotel or play at a Trump golf course or do anything else with the Trumps, if you direct bill, they'll disgorge the profits, they say. We aren't seeing any records of that. But if you just put it on your American Express card, then you aren't reported as having been a foreign government. That should tell us a lot about how the Trump administration is trying to create the appearance that they're sensitive to conflicts of interest, when in fact they're just kleptocrats. They're out to take every dollar for themselves they can.
And Kathleen Clark, what about the history of the country, going all the way back to Federalist Paper number 68? Has there ever been anything remotely comparable to what we're seeing and what you guys have described?
I'm not aware of any precedent like this. We've had scandals before. We've had government officials who have taken advantage of their authority. And I think on the state and local levels, we've sometimes seen governments being taken over and really just exploited for the personal benefit of government officials. There was a small town in California, I believe, called Bell, the city of Bell, where it was just the city was almost a shell, just really for the purpose of enriching government officials. But I don't know that we've ever seen this on the in our history, but we have seen similar problems arise in other countries, particularly where, you know, autocracy is accompanied by kleptocracy, where it's not just about gaining power, but about gaining wealth. And that's, I think, what we're in the midst of. We're being cleaned out by this con man.
Okay, you have both made that point very strongly. David K. Johnston, this is supposed to be a nationalistic administration, and the base of support for Donald Trump, presumably, is concerned about the United States and more so than the rest of the world. How does the behavior of the administration comport with that? And do you think that if the base realized what was going on, it would still be supportive?
Well, the portion of Donald's base that's racist, that hates the civil rights movement, they're not going to change. But the economic portion of his base, I think, may well begin to realize that the policies that are being pursued here are not in America's interest. The problem is that many of these policies will take time to play out. Let's take the tariff, for example, that out of the blue, Trump announces 25% tariff on imported steel and 10% on aluminum. But he's talking about raw steel and raw aluminum. So if you're a car maker in Japan who ships a finished car to the U.S., the tariff doesn't apply to you. And who pays the price of the tariff? Americans do, through higher prices. It's effectively a tax on imported goods. And you may pay the price if there's retaliation, as there's likely to be, if your job is export dependent, in exporting goods from the United States. That doesn't mean that our trade agreements are hunky-dory. They're not. There are a lot of things I've written about. You've had me on the show in the past to talk about. But there's a huge difference between getting out a scalpel to excise rotten portions of these agreements and pulling out a shotgun and firing indiscriminately with both barrels. And that's what Trump has done, because Donald doesn't know anything about geopolitics. And particularly, even though he was given a degree in economics, and I emphasize that verb given by Penn, he didn't earn it. He doesn't know anything about economics. He doesn't even understand that tariffs are a tax on the American people.
Anything further either of you would like to add, Kathleen Clark?
I would like to add one thing. I want to come back to the emoluments clause and how it can be enforced. I want to acknowledge that there are a couple of other lawsuits that have been filed regarding the emoluments clause. And one of the lawsuits was filed by members of Congress, by dozens of members of Congress. And I think that lawsuit may actually be able to, come to fruition. I don't think that one is going to be tossed out. And so it is conceivable that we may get that a court may get involved in ensuring that Congress at least has the information on what benefits is the president receiving from foreign governments. Because as I said, under the Constitution, under the Emoluments Clause, Congress can consent to the receipt of benefits, but it can't consent if it doesn't have that information. And so that's really the premise of that congressional lawsuit. I believe it's Blumenthal v. Trump. And I feel optimistic about that as a possible way to move forward and prevent our nation from being cleaned out by this con man.
Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut.
Correct.
David, anything further from you?
Well, I think that the Emoluments Clause and other issues all address a point that I think all Americans should be able to agree on, whether you love Donald Trump or you can't stand him. And that is, we are supposed to be governed by law. And if you're not complying with the law and you don't get the law changed, you're just thumbing your nose at it, we should all be alarmed about that, because that's a long-term threat to our individual liberties, and it's a long-term threat to whether the United States of America will endure.
David K. Johnston, Kathleen Clark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David K. Johnston, author of The Making of Donald Trump and It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration's Doing to America. Kathleen Clark, legal and government ethics professor at Washington University School of Law in St. Louis. Jared Kushner's apparent conflicts are just one potential scandal plaguing the White House. Another is the so-called dossier. That's actually a collection of reports by former British spy Christopher Steele. It is the central point of contention in the political brawl around Special Counsel Robert Mueller and his investigation of Russian involvement in last year's election. That's according to Tom Hamburger of The Washington Post. He has written that those who believe Steele call him a hero. Those who don't say he is merely a hired gun leading a political attack on President Trump. Tom, good to have you on our podcast.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Tell us about Steele and what you refer to as dual obligations that he had.
Well, Christopher Steele, Warren, as you mentioned in the intro, was a British spy, worked for the vaunted MI6 British Foreign Intelligence Service for 20 years, 22 years, I think, to be exact, had quite a distinguished career there, and then went into the private sector, as so many of our intel and former government officials and former journalists do these days. So he is both a consultant, a paid contractor in this case during 2016 to a firm that was had been hired by the law firm representing Hillary Clinton's campaign and the Democratic National Committee. That's one loyalty. On the other hand, he had a very deep sense of loyalty as a former British public servant, and a loyalty to what he has described to friends as the sort of national security obligations of the West, including Britain and its longstanding relationship with the United States.
Tell us, first of all, about those obligations. What did he mean by saying that he had a public duty to reveal things that are very damaging to President Trump?
So Steele, and I wanted to make clear at the outset, Warren, Steele has not said anything publicly in recent months, in part because he's been cooperating with investigators and he's facing a series of libel lawsuits because of claims or charges that appeared in the dossier that you referred to at the outset. But Steele, with a colleague, I reported on Steele's biography and his background, his career at MI6, and we talked with some of his former colleagues and even his former boss at MI6, and they describe, as is true with other British public servants and public servants in the U.S. as well, but particularly in MI6, I think there's a long-standing sense of obligation and duty that comes with being a public servant working for Her Majesty's intelligence services. And One of the things that he has described to friends, and we've interviewed his colleagues at his current firm, and as I said, his former colleagues at the British Spy Agency, and they describe someone who is sort of deeply, has a deep sense of kind of honor and obligation, and also described to us how Steele, in 2016, while he's working for a private sector client, comes into information he views as not only terribly disturbing, but something that puts the security of the United States and the West at risk. And because of that, he felt an obligation to basically breach the usual confidentiality that he had with a private sector client, in this case, Fusion GPS, a firm that was that hired him using funds, as I said, from a law firm representing Hillary Clinton's campaign and the DNC. He felt an obligation to sort of breach that confidentiality and duty to client and proceed in part out of duty to country to inform the FBI and eventually his own government of what he had learned about Russian attempts to interfere with the U.S. election in 2016.
What had he learned, and in what ways did it affect the, or might it have affected the security of the United States and the Western world?
So this is what we understand from interviewing the people who hired Chris Steele, looking at congressional testimony, as I mentioned, interviewing the folks who know Steele very well. He is hired during the early part, during about May of 2016, by this Washington-based Fusion GPS firm to provide some research, as his consulting firm based in London is perhaps uniquely capable of providing, on some what were thought to be sort of missing details in the biography of Donald Trump, and particularly the biography of his efforts to do business in Russia and the former Soviet Union. Fusion GPS, which is a Washington-based consulting firm that has in its employ mostly former journalists and some former government officials, had noted with some interest that Donald Trump had attempted to do business in Russia, but they found it a bit of a black hole. And so they hired Christopher Steele, really the when he was in government service in Britain, considered one of the UK's leading experts on Russia. He had been early in his career an undercover agent in Moscow for the British government. He'd maintained his expertise and contacts, and so he was hired really to fill in these sort of holes, as I said, in the Trump kind of corporate biography. A few weeks into it, Warren, he came up with information that stunned him and, as he told friends, he found deeply unnerving.
Hair-raising, you reported.
Hair-raising, yes, thank you. It was that information was really twofold, and it's described in the very first entry in this, what's now become known as the dossier. The first memo he sends back to his client in Washington describes a multi-year, a couple of things. One is a multi-year effort to cultivate Donald Trump, but both by providing economic incentives and perhaps building up material that would could make Trump potentially subject to pressure or perhaps blackmail. And second, he describes from his Russia sources an effort to interfere in the U.S. election on Trump's behalf, an effort that he says in this very first report that was directed and overseen by Vladimir Putin himself. And this memo is dated, as I remember, late June 2016, and is sort of these claims were considered stunning at the time, according to the people who received them, and really met with almost disbelief. But as you know, Warren, and as your listeners know, those claims have actually since been borne out by U.S., British, and other Western intelligence services as accurate.
And we have seen indictments resulted, indictments of Russians and some of the people in the Trump administration, although not directly related to the dossier, as I understand. the latter. Well, did the Clinton campaign, for whom Mr. Steele was working as a client, ever use this information against Donald Trump? Did it go to the Obama White House after Steele had reported it to the FBI?
So these are some very good questions. What happened to this Steele information? How was it? Who learned about it in the U.S. government? How was it used? Was it used? When were U.S. government officials informed? And it turns out to be quite a complicated tale. One thing I wanted to make clear, Warren, just going back to your previous comment, is that although Steele's insights provided in late June, July, and then through the summer of 2016 turn out to be prescient, and many of the broad points, if not the specifics, have been confirmed, it is not clear that what role or how significant a role his dossier played in the developing case now embraced or now being looked at by Bob Mueller and the Office of Special Counsel and previously by the FBI's counterintelligence division. We know that it was a factor, but there were other factors as well. And Steele's dossier gets a great deal of attention, but perhaps outsized credit for providing the early warning flags. There are other warnings that appeared that we now know that the Obama administration was aware of. To your next question, how did the Clinton campaign use this information? The response to us is a bit murky and a bit surprising. One of the things that we have been told by very senior people in the campaign is that they were not aware of Steele's dossier. They weren't, some weren't, even very senior people in the campaign weren't aware that Steele had been hired by the campaign's law firm through this Fusion GPS firm. They learned about it later, and there are some gnashing of teeth and some angry and outraged comments from people both in the Clinton campaign and in the Obama administration who say, why wasn't this flagged earlier and in a more emphatic way? And why, since these reports were coming in from a somewhat renowned expert on Russian intelligence matters, why wasn't there an early warning both inside the administration and even to voters before the 2016 election occurred?
Okay, now we have Republican Senators Lindsey Graham and Charles Grassley recommending that there be a criminal investigation of Steele. Obviously, they don't believe him. Where do they get their information?
So one of the Mueller investigation has proceeded, there have been concurrent investigations, if you will, led in the House by the House Intelligence Committee and the House Judiciary Committee, and in the Senate, really by the Senate Judiciary Committee, chaired by Senator Chuck Grassley, and on that committee sits also Senator Lindsey Graham, and they have not been critical of Bob Mueller, the special counsel particularly, but they have raised questions insistently about the conduct of the FBI and the extent to which, and they're very focused on this, the extent to which the FBI relied on data from and information from Chris Steele and even from others who may have had a link, in Steele's case it's a financial link, to the Clinton campaign, suggesting, and the White House has repeated this, the President of the United States has even tweeted about it, suggesting that, in fact, the real collusion or the real thing to be concerned about in this case is not Russian interference with the U.S. election on behalf of Donald Trump, but, in fact, some interference led by the Clinton campaign and its supporters to create a false narrative of Russian interference in the campaign. So in the midst of these sort of concurrent investigations, Senator Grassley and Senator Graham, two very widely respected members of the Senate and of the Judiciary Committee, both Republicans, did something unusual and noteworthy. They filed a criminal referral. They sent a criminal referral to the U.S. Justice Department saying, you recommending a criminal investigation, basically, of Steele, they said, for lying, lying to FBI agents about his contacts with news organizations. And, and of course, lying to an FBI agent, if proved, is a felony, if true. And they requested an investigation, and it really sent some shockwaves. We learned not only to Chris Steele and his colleagues, who think of themselves as patriots and were quite unnerved to be find themselves the subject of a criminal referral, but also even through the British intelligence establishment, and we suspect the British government as well.
You have met with Steele. What do you think of him?
So we met with Steele. We were among a handful of journalists who met with Steele during 2016. There was a time when he decided, and he, at the direction of the Fusion GPS firm that had hired him, to brief reporters on a background basis. Our original agreement was that we wouldn't disclose the source of this briefing, but we now have permission to do that, though we can't go warrant into all of the details. But Mr. Steele came by the Washington Post. He's a very he's a composed guy, seemed quite calm, has a sense of humor. We met with him two times, once in September and again early in September and again in October. Warren, the second time that we met with him, I'd say the sort of traditional British cool veneer had frayed some, and he was obviously to us kind of agitated. What had happened? Why was there not more? What's happened to the reporting on the sort of tips and concerns that he had raised about Russian interference? He was following it by this point quite closely what was happening in U.S. politics, and was very interested in whether the FBI, with whom he'd had a long-standing relationship, was taking his intelligence information seriously.
And one final thing that has developed is the suspicion that perhaps the Russians had something to do with the president's appointment or non-appointment of Mitt Romney to be Secretary of State. Does that come from Steele, too?
Well, apparently so. So my my fellow journalist, Jane Mayer, wrote in The New Yorker, in the current issue, an extensive piece on Chris Steele. And she has this piece of bit of new information, that is this, that Steele prepared an additional memo, previously unreported, that went to Mueller and his team, citing a single source who said that the Russians were engaged after the election in blocking Mitt Romney, who was sort of a famous Republican GOP skeptic of Russia and Putin's regime, and sent the message to Trump or his people that appointing Romney would not be a good idea for the future. And you may recall that Romney was indeed sort of auditioning for a possible Secretary of State role, though he ultimately didn't get it. So there is apparently, according to the New Yorker, a report that Steele has post-election sent on to the Justice Department suggesting or quoting a Russian source saying the Russians wanted to block Mitt Romney as Donald Trump's Secretary of State.
Just in the past few days, it appears that there was a Russian hit on and former Russian spy and his daughter, not, of course, Christopher Steele. This happened in Britain. Are Steele and perhaps his family in danger?
Well, so that has been one of the concerns, and when the Senate Judiciary Committee asked the Fusion GPS founder Glenn Simpson about this and about his relationship with Steele, one of the things that he expressed at the outset was the concern that he, Steele, and others have that there may be some Russian retribution. The fear, as we understand it, was not directly against Steele and his family, though you recall that they went into hiding for some weeks after they were first identified, but rather for the concern that was expressed, as we understand it from the congressional testimony, was about those sources that Steele may rely on. And you may recall that there were a series of peculiar deaths in Russia just after Steele was identified as the author of the dossier. Now, no one has ever shown us and made a public claim that those deaths were directly related to Christopher Steele's dossier, but it is something that is talked about and, as I mentioned, was talked about behind closed doors in these congressional committee hearings.
Do you think we'll have to wait for the special counsel to determine what, in fact, actually happened and where, if perhaps this is a bad metaphor, all the bodies lie?
Well, we're going to, you know, we are all sort of waiting to see what Bob Mueller is going to do, reading the tea leaves as best we can. It's a very closed and disciplined operation. And really, Mueller knows how extensive this investigation is and, of course, where it is likely to go. But I did want to reiterate, Warren, something at the outset. Well, there's a great deal of controversy about Steele and his dossier, and there are claims, and they're backed up by some evidence that there are some things that he got wrong, some details, some names that may not be accurate. But I keep going back to that very first memo that described this attempt by the Kremlin to interfere with the election on behalf of Donald Trump. And we do know that at least in that broad warning, Steele was correct and has been proven correct, at least by the testimony of U.S. And Western intelligence agencies.
All right. And let us not forget that we were talking about something that the president still insists is a witch hunt. Tom Hamburger with The Washington Post. It's wonderful to have you on our podcast. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you, Warren.
This podcast produced by Andrea Brody and Devin Schwartz. Our engineer is Joel Stein. I'm Warren Olney. To the Point is available on Apple Podcasts, other platforms, and at kcrw.com/To the Point. Join us again and again and again.